But after this morning, there's a bit of a kind of change in tone, if you like, in this letter. It kind of turns a corner a bit. Up till now, Paul has been making this whole series of arguments in different ways to try and convince the Galatians that they're not to try and receive God's blessing by the things that they do. That's been his big point, hasn't it, if you remember, that we've seen over and over again, really, over the last few weeks. But after this week, when I come back from my holiday, Paul begins to show us something else. He begins to show us how it is that we're to live as Christians, now that we have this glorious freedom, now that we're not enslaved to following the law, to doing things again anymore. How are we to live? So there's a kind of a shift in what we'll be seeing from Galatians after that. But this morning we have the last of this kind of set of Paul's arguments to show them that they're not able to be made right with God by the things that they do. Now I should warn you as we start that this passage has the reputation of being one of the most difficult parts of the entire Bible to understand. So I hope you're up for a challenge this morning. Some of the details are very tricky, but actually the big idea is fairly clear, so don't let that put you off. I hope I haven't scared you too much already. Even if we don't get to grips with every single detail, I think the big picture will be fairly clear to us. We'll be able to see the main point that Paul is making. One of the reasons that it does seem so tricky is that Paul seems to be arguing in a very strange way. You may have noticed that as we read it. He talks about two women who actually are two covenants, but they also represent mountains and cities, and it's all very strange really to us, isn't it? Paul doesn't seem to really talk this way anywhere else in the Bible apart from here. In fact, the rest of the Bible doesn't really seem to argue this way. It may be that Paul is doing that because he's deliberately copying the style of the kind of Jewish teachers at the time. If you remember that the situation in Galatia was that people had come from Jerusalem to try and convince the Christians that they needed to follow the Old Testament law. And it may be that they were using these kinds of arguments, and they sounded very impressive, and the Galatians were getting convinced by them. And so Paul is perhaps saying, well, two can play at that game. You're impressed by that. Let me show you I can do that just as well as they can. And in fact, it doesn't prove their point at all. Actually, even if I do that, it shows that what I've been saying all along is true. So it may be that that's why Paul does things in this way here, but it takes us a little bit of work to get our heads around it. So we're going to look at three things from this passage. We're going to look at it in three sections this morning. First of all, we need to remind ourselves of the incident in the Old Testament that Paul is talking about, that he's basing this on. It's an incident about two sons. Then we'll see what those sons represent. It's an incident about two covenants. And then we'll see Paul making two applications at the end. So that's what we're going to look at in this passage. So let's begin by having a look at these two sons. Let's just remind ourselves what was going on in the Galatian churches. These people had come from Jerusalem, and they were telling the Galatian Christians that as well as having faith in Christ, they had, in order to be really acceptable to God, they had to do something else. They had to follow various laws laid down in the Old Testament. These people came and they said, look at us, we're Jews, we're sons of Abraham. We're Abraham's flesh and blood. We've been circumcised in the flesh. That's who we are. We've had these laws for hundreds of years. They've been a great blessing to us. They're the thing that has kept us in the right, kept us pure and acceptable to God. And if you want to join in with us, if you want to be acceptable, you need to follow these laws as well. And then you'll be real Christians. You'll be real kosher Christians. And the Galatians, they're beginning to say, yes, that's what we want. Of course we do. We want to be under the law. If we want to be blessed, we've got to join in with these sons of Abraham. And so, yeah, we'll start to follow the law. And we've seen that they were starting to follow the food regulations. And we saw last time they're starting to follow the Jewish calendar, the feasts and the Sabbaths and so on. And they're also thinking about being circumcised in accordance with the law. But look at what Paul says in verse 21. He says, "You Galatians are very keen on the law, but I'm not sure you actually know what the law says." That's what he says, isn't it? "Tell me, you who want to be under the law, are you not aware of what the law says? Do you really understand what the law is saying?" And so Paul begins to tell them what the law actually says about the sons of Abraham. And he's using the law refers not just to the commands and the rules in the Old Testament, but to the first five books. So he's going right back to Genesis here, to Abraham, before the law, in terms of the rules and commands, the Mosaic law was given at Mount Sinai. So he goes back to the law to tell them what the law says. And the first thing that he needs to remind them is that Abraham actually had two sons. For it is written, verse 22, that Abraham had two sons. In fact, Abraham had more sons than just the two, but there are two that are particularly important and significant here. See, God had promised Abraham that he would bless him, hadn't he? And the way that God would bless him would be through his offspring, through his sons. And he would give him many descendants, and God would make Abraham into a great nation. But the problem was that Sarah, Abraham's wife, was well past the age when she would be able to have children. In fact, she was over 90, so really well past the age when she would be able to have children normally. And years had passed since God had made that promise to Abraham to give him a son. And yet still they didn't have a son. And it seemed as if they never would have one. It seemed impossible, didn't it, for Sarah ever to have a son. And so in the end they decided, Abraham and Sarah together, that if they were going to get this blessing that God had promised to them, then they'd have to do something about it themselves. There was no good sitting around waiting. They needed to take the initiative and get on and do something to get it. And so Sarah gave Abraham one of her slave girls, Hagar, to sleep with. And Hagar got pregnant and gave birth to a son, Ishmael. But actually, that was not the way that God was going to fulfill his promise. We read about this earlier in our service in Genesis 21. The way that God was going to fulfill his promise was not through Ishmael, the son of Hagar. He was going to give Sarah herself a son. And we read earlier about how God kept his promise and Sarah gave birth to Isaac, even at the age of 90. And so, as Paul says in verse 22 here in Galatians, Abraham had two sons, Ishmael and Isaac. One of them, Ishmael, by the slave woman, Hagar, and one son, Isaac, by the free woman, Sarah. And Paul points out the difference between those two sons in verse 23. Hagar's son was born in the ordinary way. It actually says there that he was born according to the flesh. That means that he was born by their human effort. They decided, didn't they, that if they were going to receive the blessing, they needed to act on it. They needed to do something about it. And so they did something themselves by their human effort. They tried to gain God's blessing, God's promise. Hagar's son was the son of doing it yourself, of trying to achieve God's blessing by what you do. But Sarah's son was very different. He was born as the result of God's promise, wasn't he? There wasn't anything, was there, that they could have done to make a 90-year-old woman give birth. It could only come about because of what God did. If God did the work, if he did a miracle. And that's what God did. He kept his promise. And Isaac was born. Not because of their own effort, but because of God's work, God's faithfulness in keeping his promise. So that's the key thing to remember about these two sons that we have here and that run all the way through this passage. Hagar's son was the result of human effort, of doing it yourself. And Sarah's son was simply the result of God's work, of God's faithfulness to his promise. Abraham had two sons. And so the big question for these Judaizers, these people who've come up from Jerusalem, is which of these two sons are they? They claim to be sons of Abraham, don't they? That's their big thing. That's the reason they think that they're going to receive God's blessing, because we are Abraham's sons, they say. But are they like Hagar's son, or are they Sarah's son? Are they sons of slavery, or are they free sons of the promise? Now, actually, that question is really important. It really matters what kind of son you are. Because only one of those sons actually got the blessing in the end. Only one of them shared in the inheritance. Now, have a look at verse 30 down towards the end there. This is actually a quotation that we read in Genesis earlier. And Paul quotes it again here. But what does the scripture say? Get rid of the slave woman and her son, for the slave woman's son will never share in the inheritance with the free woman's son. You see, it's only if you're a son of Sarah, of the free woman, that you receive all the blessings of God. If you're a son like Hagar's son, like Ishmael, an illegitimate son, then you don't receive anything of the inheritance. It matters what kind of son you are. It matters who your mother is. Now, here's a kind of historical puzzle for you, for people who are into this kind of thing. Charles II, he was king of England, Scotland and Ireland. I'm not sure what happened to Wales at that time. They were probably kicking up a fuss or something. He was king from 1660 to 1685, so a while ago. Charles had a number of sons, and his eldest son was James, the first Duke of Monmouth. And so when Charles died, James tried to claim the throne, but he never became king. In fact, he was captured and executed. So, do you know why, as the eldest son, he was not allowed to be king? Well, the reason was because of who his mother was. King Charles II was his father, but his mother was Charles's mistress, a woman called Lucy Walter. And because of that, James was not allowed to be king. He didn't have any claim to the throne, not because he wasn't descended from the king. He was the king's son, but his mother was not the king's wife. And it's the same situation here, isn't it? It's only Sarah's sons, legitimate sons, who will receive God's blessings, who will join in the inheritance. And so, of course, these people who come from Jerusalem, they were saying, that's us. Look at us. We can trace our family tree all the way back. Down through the ages, back to Isaac, back to Sarah, back to Abraham. We're the legitimate sons. We're the ones who are going to be blessed. But in verses 24 to 28, Paul says, actually, you've got that completely wrong. You've got that the wrong way round. Those, you Jews, you people who are trying to be right with God by following the law, you're not Sarah's sons at all. Actually, you're Hagar's sons, your illegitimate children. You're not the ones who are going to share in the inheritance. Can you imagine what a shocking thing that would have been for these people to hear? They've been brought up all their life confident that they would receive God's blessing, that God's all of God's good things were for them because of who their fathers were, because of their ancestry. And then Paul says, actually, you're illegitimate children. You're not Abraham's true sons at all. That's a big claim, isn't it, for Paul to make? And it seems like a very difficult claim to defend. How does he say that? They definitely were the physical descendants of Sarah, weren't they? There's no argument about that. They could trace their family line all the way back. They physically were descended from Abraham by Sarah. So how does Paul say that actually they're like sons of Hagar? Well, what Paul says is that being a son of Abraham is much more than just who you're physically descended from. It's not about being able to trace your family line back through the ages, back to Sarah, or to Hagar, in fact. What kind of son you are depends on what you're like. Are you a son who is like Isaac? Or are you a son who is like Ishmael? Now, I'm not completely sure about this, but I think that is partly what Paul means in verse 24 when he says these things may be taken figuratively. What he's doing there is telling us that when we want to see who is a genuine son and who's an illegitimate son, we need to look beyond just physical descent, who the father and the grandfather and so on are. These two mothers, Sarah and Hagar, and their sons, they represent something spiritual, something beyond just physical descent. And that's what we need to look at if we want to find out what kind of son somebody is. And in fact, Jesus said almost exactly the same thing. Let's just have a look at that. I put it on the screen for you so you can see. Jesus here is speaking to some Jews, and they come to him and they say to him, "Abraham is our father." You see, they're making exactly the same kind of claim. "We're okay because Abraham is our father," they say. Jesus says, "If you were Abraham's children," said Jesus, "then you would do the things Abraham did. As it is, you're determined to kill me." "We are not illegitimate children," they protested. Do you see that Jesus is saying the same thing to them there? The true mark of whose son you are is what you do. Who are you like? These Jews were not doing the kinds of things that Abraham did. And so Jesus' assertion is very clear to them, isn't it? "We are not illegitimate children," they protested. They can see what Jesus is saying. He says they're like illegitimate sons because they don't do the things that Abraham did. So what about these people back in Paul's day that were troubling the Galatians? What were they like? They make this same claim to be Abraham's children. But what are they really like? Well, in verse 24 onwards, Paul takes us through a whole set of evidence. I don't know if you like those kind of TV police dramas. Sometimes you see this kind of thing on TV. The police are looking for a criminal, and they have a whole range of suspects, kind of five or six people perhaps, who have the opportunity to commit the crime, and they don't know which one of those it is. But fortunately, there's an eyewitness who saw somebody do it, and so they get the witness sitting down with a sketch artist, and they describe what they've seen, and the sketch artist is scribbling away. To heighten the drama on TV, you don't see what they're drawing until they get to the end. And then they kind of turn their sketch pad around, and suddenly we know who the criminal is, don't we? Because their face is staring at us out of the paper. The sketch matches one of the suspects. It's a kind of dramatic moment. Well, that's a bit like what Paul is doing here. He's sketching a picture of what Hagar and her sons are like. And then he holds it up and he says, "So, who matches this picture? Who is really like this?" So let's look at the evidence together that he pieces together into this sketch. I'm going to put it up on the screen to help us to just keep track of that as we go along. We've seen a couple of things already, haven't we? We've seen that Hagar's son was the son of trying to gain God's blessing by human effort. That's how he came about. It's all about doing it yourself. And also we've seen, haven't we, that he was a slave. He was the son of a slave woman, a slave himself. But now Paul adds a few more things in these verses. So in verse 24, he says that Hagar represents the covenant that came from Mount Sinai. That's the Jewish law, the rules and the regulations and so on. God gave it to Moses at Sinai. And Paul makes a connection between Hagar and between this covenant, the Jewish law that came at Sinai. I think that the reason that Hagar is connected to Sinai is that Hagar's offspring, the Ishmaelites, lived in that part of the world. They lived all around that region in the desert of Sinai. The Arabs in that region were called sons of Hagar. So there's a connection there between Hagar and Sinai. But of course, the bigger connection is that the law that came from Sinai was based on needing to do things, wasn't it? Just the same way that Hagar's son came about through needing to do something to gain God's blessing. Back in chapter 3 and verse 12, Paul quotes from the law itself, and he says, "The man who does these things will live by them." The covenant that came at Sinai was all about doing things to gain God's blessing. Hagar's son was the son of doing it yourself. The law was the law of doing it yourself. They are both trying to gain God's blessing through human effort. So if we look at those three things that we've got there, who is that a picture of? Whose face emerges from that sketch? Who does that fit? Who is it who's trying to obtain God's blessing by human effort, who's enslaved, and who has the Jewish law at Sinai right at the centre of what they do? Well, it's a picture of this Jewish circumcision group, isn't it? These people who've come from Jerusalem. They're the ones who think that God's blessing is established by their human effort. In fact, their whole claim is based on the flesh, isn't it? It's based on their fleshy descent, if you like, from Abraham, and on their circumcision in the flesh. It was all about the flesh. But it's also them who were slaves. Paul's been telling us that, hasn't he? The people who try and gain acceptance with God by what they do end up enslaved because they have to keep on working harder and harder. But they're never able actually to achieve the standard that they set. And of course they're the ones who are centred around Sinai, who have the Jewish law right at the centre. And so it's no surprise, is it, that Paul says what he says in verse 25, that he concludes that the people who are like this correspond to the present city of Jerusalem, to those who are following the Jewish law. Those are the people who are like the sons of Hagar, the illegitimate sons. And so this is an amazing turnaround, isn't it, to their way of thinking, to the way of thinking of these Judaizers who've come up from Jerusalem. When we look at Hagar and Sarah in terms of physical descent, well, it seems like they're okay. But when we look at them figuratively, well, it's clear that they are the illegitimate sons, that they're sons of Hagar, sons who will not inherit God's blessing. So who are the true sons? Well, I'll put them up on the screen. We're not going to look at these in as much detail. But these are some of the things that Paul says about Sarah's sons, about the true sons in these verses. You can follow these up at home or you can ask me about them later. If you are going to look this up at home, then the key thing to look at is that quotation there that Paul makes, which is from Isaiah chapter 54. Be glad, O barren woman who bears no children. Those few lines there. If you look up that in Isaiah 54 and read the whole chapter, you'll see why Paul says that. You'll see that it's the sons, or you'll see how the barren women's children are connected to God's city in heaven, the heavenly Jerusalem. But what Paul shows us here is that legitimate, true sons of Abraham receive God's blessing simply through God's promises, not through trying to do it themselves. And because of that, they're free. They're free children. They're free from the slavery of keeping the law. Like Sarah's son Isaac, they're children of the barren woman. She didn't have any children, well into her 90s. And they're members of the heavenly Jerusalem, the true kingdom of God. All of those things come out of Isaiah 54, if you look that up later. And so who are those people? Well, it should be clear to us, shouldn't it? They're the people who trust in God to fulfill his promises. Not the ones who try and get it themselves by their own effort, but the ones who don't try and make any contribution themselves, but simply trust in God. The true sons are the ones that see that God has fulfilled his promises in Jesus. The true sons of Abraham are people like these Galatian Christians that Paul is writing to here. And in fact, that's exactly what Paul says to them in verse 28. He says, now you brothers, like Isaac, are children of promise. The true sons of Abraham are these Christians in Galatia and people like us, if we are trusting not in our own efforts, but in what God has done to bring us his blessing. Well, you'll be pleased to hear, I think, that that's the end of the really complicated bit. If you didn't manage to follow any of that, well, I apologise, but if you've switched off, then this is a good time to switch back on. We're going to bring out a few applications that Paul makes here now. If you didn't really follow where we were going with the detail of that, the important thing to remember is this. This is what Paul's been trying to show us. He's been trying to show us that people who rely on keeping the law are illegitimate children. illegitimate sons of Abraham, and they have no inheritance. And he's been trying to show us that the true sons are the people who rely completely on God's promise that he will bless them, and not on trying to do it themselves. So that's the big point that Paul has been making. So let's finish with two applications, which are two applications that Paul makes in this passage. And the first one is this. If you're a child of promise, a child of the promise, you can expect persecution. If you're a child of the promise, you can expect persecution. Have a look at verse 29. Paul says, at that time, the son born in the ordinary way, that's Ishmael, persecuted the son born by the power of the Spirit. That's Isaac. It is the same now. So we read that in Genesis 21 earlier. We read how Ishmael, who was 14 years older than Isaac, even at the time when Isaac was being weaned, when he was about 3 years old, he mocked and bullied Isaac to such an extent that he had to be sent away. And Paul says that it's just the same now. The circumcision group and the Jews, those who are relying on what they do to be right with God, were persecuting the Christians, those who were right with God simply by God's work. And in fact, it's been like that throughout history, hasn't it? Christians have often faced persecution, not by complete unbelievers, not by people who are not religious at all, who are miles away from the church, but by people who are part of the religious establishment, but people who are relying on what they do for their salvation. It's always been that way throughout history. Ishmaels persecute Isaacs. That's the way it's always been. That was true for Jesus, wasn't it? He was hunted down by the religious Jewish leaders. It was true, if you think about it, at the time of the Reformation, for example, when it was the medieval Roman Catholic Church that was ruthless in trying to wipe out true believers. And it's often true today, isn't it, in churches? The biggest problems, the biggest opposition, very often don't come from people outside, people who are unconnected with the church, but from people inside, people who seem to be religious. So let me just give you one example of that. In the last few years or so, a number of evangelical Anglican churches started allowing people who were not ordained to lead communion. That seems like a kind of quite normal thing for us, I think, but it was a big thing for them. They began to see that to restrict that role just to a vicar or a priest or whoever, whatever they called him, was to deny what Jesus had done in the gospel, that Jesus made us all priests to serve him. Now that was massively opposed. The people who did that came in for all sorts of abuse. They had all kinds of bad press, all kinds of difficulty. But that didn't come from people outside the church. People outside the church couldn't have cared two hoots about it, probably. The opposition came from people inside the church. But people who were relying on rules and on laws and on traditions, rather than relying on what Christ had done in the gospel and enjoying the freedom that that brings. And it may well be exactly the same for us. I'm sure that many of us who've been around churches for a while can think of examples that we may have experienced where the gospel has been opposed by people inside the church. And really, that's just a demonstration, again, of people's slavery, isn't it? Religious people, people who think that relying on rules and laws and traditions is what makes them right with God, are always going to be very touchy, aren't they, if those things are threatened. If things look as if they're going to change, that's really going to get their backs up, because it's those things that they're relying on. Their salvation depends on those things, as they see it. And so it's the people who are relying on rules and traditions that will always oppose those kinds of changes. The thing that they have built their hope on is threatened. But people who rely on God's work through the gospel are free from that kind of thing, aren't they? It doesn't matter to them what's changed, because their salvation doesn't depend on that. It depends simply on what God has done. And so they're secure in what Christ has done for them. And so if we live in this freedom that Christ brings, if we live as children of the promise, then Paul says we can expect to face persecution and opposition. That's the first application. The second one is this. And the second thing that Paul tells us is that there is no blessing if we rely on human effort. So don't go back to it. Don't go back to it. Have a look at verse 30. What does the scripture say? Get rid of the slave woman and her son. For the slave woman's son will never share in the inheritance with the free woman's son. Now, some people have suggested that what Paul is doing here is telling the Galatians to cast these Judaizers out of the church, to get rid of them. I'm not sure that's quite the way to understand this verse. I think that what he's doing is using this verse to remind the Galatians not to go back to relying on their own efforts. He's reminding them what the destiny is of people who do that. People who try to gain God's blessing by their own efforts will never share in the inheritance. That's a great warning, isn't it? Don't go that way. It doesn't lead to blessing. You'll not share in the inheritance if you do that. Now, there is a very real temptation for us to think the way that Abraham did with Hagar. To think, God has promised to bless me. I believe that. I believe it's God's work. I believe that he's the one who does it. But I need to do something as well. I have to bring it about. I have to contribute to that. That's the way that Abraham thought, wasn't it? It wasn't that he completely disbelieved God, in a sense. He believed that God was going to bless him. But he believed that that would only come about if he did something towards it, if he contributed. Do you see how subtle that is? It's not denying that it's God who blesses. It's not denying that we need to believe him. It's just saying that we need to do something ourselves. We need to contribute towards it. We need to play our part to make it happen. Perhaps the way to uncover that in our own thinking is to think about how you'd finish this statement. How would you complete this sentence? God will accept me into heaven because. How would we finish that? If we say something like this, God will accept me into heaven because Jesus died for me and I have been obedient to him. Or maybe we'd say, because God saved me and ever since then I've done my best to follow him. Do you see what that's doing? That's thinking like Abraham with Hagar, isn't it? That's making us like Hagar's sons. We think the reason we're accepted is because of God's work combined with a little bit of our own effort. But remember that Hagar's sons will not share in the inheritance. Our salvation is not a joint effort. It's not that God wakes us up and sets us on our feet and then we have to do something ourselves. We have to get there. We have to run the race. It's not like that. God not only sets us on our feet and makes us alive, but Christ has run the race for us. He carries us through to the end. It is all of his effort and nothing that we contribute. And so it's only when we fully rely on God's work, when we know that nothing that we do contributes towards that, that we are true sons, sons of the promise, and heirs to a glorious inheritance.